Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will sit down with Dr. Corey Goodlett, owner and managing partner with Todd County Animal Clinic in Elkton, Kentucky. As always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How is David and Vicki this morning?
Good. We've had a lot of good weather to get a lot of crop planted here in the last little bit.
You know, we record these things sometimes multiples at a time, so it's been a couple weeks since we've been together.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing because we've all been busy.
That's right.
The weather has broke. Mm-hmm. It is officially springtime, and
yep.
A lot of corn and a lot of soybean, full-season beans, have been planted in the past 10 days.
Absolutely. And we had an opportunity. Vicki and I did. Jay was out of the mix, but we had an opportunity to plant our Tri-County corn plot, so that went over real well. We even planted a soybean plot on the same day, just right across the road from that. So we've been busy, a lot of crop being planted, so everything's been going good.
Yeah, I'd have been better off if I was with y'all that day.
Yeah,
actually,
right.
I had a doctor's appointment for some pain I've been having in one foot. And while I was at the doctor's office, he said, you know, your ankle's swollen a little bit on this other foot. I said, yeah, it's sore from time to time. He said, well, let's just x-ray it while we're there. So I've got a torn tendon. He immediately put me in a walking boot and said I needed that maybe for the next 3 months. And if that didn't work, we'd have to operate. So.
Well, you look good. Wagging that around.
I spent in high school about 2 years on crutches. Yeah. Because of this same foot and basically the same injury, similar to it. So I can get around pretty good. I've learned to maneuver through the years. So
that's right.
It was a pretty drive down for me this morning. Of course, we're recording in Todd County. It was our first time to record in Todd County.
Yeah.
And so if you hadn't been here, it's a pretty little place to drive through. And it's a
pretty drive.
Beautiful agricultural drive coming down. So if you like to look at crops and, the wheat is really – really looking pretty. Now, I don't know if they're looking like there may not be a lot of damage. Is there a lot of damage down this way?
I don't really think so. I think it's kind of hit and miss.
We dodged a bullet for the most part.
I was thinking so. But it's really pretty, and I saw some corn, poking through the ground, can see the row. And
you were coming down Highway 41, which, of course, runs through your county, too.
That's right.
You're just a few counties south of where you live and work. The Dixie Beeline Highway is what that's known as. We're at the Kentucky-Tennessee Livestock Market in Guthrie, Kentucky. Mark and his staff here are kind enough to let us meet. Of course, our guest here today does a lot of work here at this stockyard, and that's kind of why we're here. We're mobile. We go to wherever we need to. So, Corey, glad to have you with us this morning.
And thank you all for having me on.
Yeah, won't you just tell a little bit about yourself, maybe the path it took you to get to Todd County and how long you've been a veterinarian?
So I was born and raised in Coleman, Alabama, went to vet school in Auburn, graduated in 2012, worked in Clarksville, Tennessee for about 7 years, and then I've been in Todd County for the last four. We have a mixed animal practice that has three, soon to be four, mixed animal veterinarians that practice on food animal, horses, and small animal.
Yeah, it's that's pretty uncommon anymore to find somebody that does all of those. And we were talking before the show, and we can get into that real quick, right off the bat. But talk a little bit about the shortage of veterinarians and how much trouble it is to find some folks that really like to work on large animals.
Yeah, and this is in Kentucky. There's about 5% of all veterinarians do large animals. So that's 50 to 60 large animal veterinarians in 120 counties. And until we can figure out how to get more young veterinarians interested in doing large animal medicine, it's going to become a crisis. Probably already is a crisis, to be honest, right now. But of the few food animal veterinarians left, over half of them's within 10 years of retirement, too.
Yeah.
So it's going to get dire pretty quick, you know. And
there's places in Kentucky that absolutely don't have much, if any, access to a large animal vet, and, you know, they have to come from several counties away, and, you know, some folks are not willing to do that. And, I mean, if it's not a crisis, it's fixing to be one for sure.
You know, David, Hopkins County, where I work, is one of those counties.
And McLean County, too.
We do not have a large animal vet. Had one come to speak at our Livestock Association meeting just last week and had to bring him from Union County over, you know, two counties over to get there. So good friend of mine operates two clinics, one in Campbellsville and one in Hodgensville, LaRue County. He come out of vet school with the idea that large animal was what he wanted to do. We grew up on horses together, you know, working cattle, and he milked for a guy growing up, and large animal is his thing. But he had to open a clinic, grow it big enough to hire another vet, and then open a second clinic and grow it big enough to hire another vet. And I think he's got three on staff now that just pretty much do small animal, and that allows him the freedom to get out and do a lot of the large animal work, even though that's what he likes. He still spends part of his time doing non-food animals, you know, veterinary practice, just because that's the demand.
Yeah, it is. And a lot, the average student coming out of school right now owes about $200,000. And there's a lot of corporate companies buying out these smaller clinics and offering, you know, signing bonuses and, you know, higher salaries than I get now, you know, paying myself. And it's hard to compete with that. And then they buy out these clinics, and then they just shut down the large animal and just do small animal. Yeah. It's more money, easier, less dangerous, you know.
Right. And you got to like it.
Well, I was going to say, from a veterinarian standpoint, I know myself, I'm in my middle 50s now. I don't take getting beat up as well as I used to. I'd say a lot of veterinarians get to that point where even if they enjoyed the large animal work, small animals are much easier on them.
Yeah, it takes a toll. I can tell it getting out of the bed in the morning. You know, it takes me a little longer than it used to.
You got a long way to go.
That's right. You just wait.
Well, and then, like you said, the more dangerous part, and then you have injuries that you got to deal with. So if you are injured, then you're kind of going to be out of pocket for a little while, and, you know, that compounds the issue with the farmers and with, you know, just not having the other vets to be able to come in and cover for you, so to speak, when you're if you're injured. Hopefully you don't, but you know, we never know what those animals are going
to
do.
Corey, are they doing anything to try to address these kind of issues? Are there some things going on maybe behind the scenes that some folks don't know about that you can tell our listeners that they may be trying to do?
Yeah, there is. The Ag Commissioner Ron Quarles is formed a committee to, you know, address the issue and, you know, try to figure out why this isn't happening and how to, you know, prevent it from happening. And the USDA has programs for veterinarians that have student loans that want to do food animal, where they get some loan repayment options that helps, you know. But I think a lot of it starts with the vet schools. You know, the students that they're teaching to give them confidence, and, you know, seeking out people that have food animal interest, you know. And then, you know, with extension agents, FFA, you know, everything, you know, guiding young kids to, you know, get interested, you know. Yeah. So.
Is it, I know there's a shortage of the large animal vets, and I mean that's clear, and that's been an issue for several years, and it's continuing to get worse. On the flip side of that, is it the opposite for the small animal? Are these vet schools graduating more graduates, and maybe those folks having trouble maybe finding the job that they wanted, you know, just because there's so many small vets, small animal vets.
I think there's still a shortage of small animal veterinarians as well. I think the generation graduating to now values their lifestyle more than, you know, people my age and older. Yeah. You know, they
us.
But you know, they want to work 32 to 48 hours a week and just go home and
go to the office and then go home.
Yeah. Right. And then not, you know, get called out in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Sure.
pull a calf or, you know, do whatever, you yeah. know, and that's...
There's know. Certainly a lot of, you know, some things with being a large animal vet that you have to... And that's where that's the reason I say you got to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
if you didn't enjoy it, you wouldn't want to get out of the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and go pull a calf.
That's exactly what I was yeah. fixing to say, David. I almost think, like you and I did, you almost have to come from a large animal background mm-hmm. growing up to yeah, enjoy those
to really
things.
Like it, yeah.
I remember when I was in college, there were a lot of pre-vet students. A lot of them were from Louisville, you know, downtown Lexington, different places, wherever they were from. They didn't grow up on a farm. They didn't grow up with large animals. So that was not their intent from the very beginning, you know.
Yep.
But, you know, there's – I feel like there's probably exactly what you're saying, that lifestyle choice is a lot of those difference for the people nowadays. I've been out of school close to 30 years, so it's – you know, obviously the people have changed some, but I think the expectations of everybody have changed of what they expect mm-hmm. out of their work and their – work-life balance, that's a term I've heard a lot. Don't really know what that means, but I've heard it a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Corey, do you think that, you know, in today's vet school, that seems to be a lot more specialization, you know, and depending on what part of the country you're in, we've all got a friend that's in Texas that all he does is equine, you know, and most of it is lameness issues and, you know, rehab and that kind of stuff. Do you see more of that maybe, you know, coming down the pike when in vet schools that, you know, obviously you have to have this broad, you know, knowledge of all animals, but do you see more specialization maybe coming down the road?
I do. And so a lot of veterinarians that are in Kentucky are from Auburn because they have the deal. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But
right.
So Auburn, they do not track, meaning you take, like when you're through your clinical rotations, you have to go through it all. Mm-hmm. Some vet schools will let you track to majority large animal, majority small animal, everything mm-hmm. like that. And that, so coming out of Auburn, you do have a greater basis of food animal and equine than mm-hmm. most, you know, mm-hmm. most vet schools do offer, which helps. But I think, you know, the people that know what they're getting into with food animal medicine, you know, that's great. But there's a lot of students, like we have a vet student at our clinic right now that wants to do food animal medicine but has never been around it. So,
right.
you know, I think it's a vet school's job, our job, you know, wherever she goes to work to – you know, cultivator to gain confidence to be able to do it, you know, because, you know, when I first got out of school, you know, I'd show up to a farm and they'd be like, where's Dr. Holder? You know, and I'm dumb enough to not even worry about it and just go do what I need to. But it's intimidating to a lot of people. And I think that's where a lot of it stops is, you know, it's just multifactorial, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
You might be hinting to a history of that vet client patient relationship there if they were expecting one person and somebody else showed up.
Yeah.
That's a good thing though. Yeah. That's a good thing to have that. So you know, I've seen this happen. This is related to a shortage of veterinarians, not necessarily large animal or small animal, but I've known a lot of people through the years because of the relationship that Kentucky has had with Auburn. I've known a lot of people that had their heart set on getting out of college, getting their bachelor's, going to Auburn, being a vet, and couldn't get in. And plenty qualified, maybe just, you know, there's that limited number of people they get to take every year. And I've known some people that even applied a second year and didn't get in. And they quit and decided to go do something else. There's a lot of other vet schools out there, and they're all different. They all probably have their uniqueness that may be a plus. But I've known a lot of people that their decision was, their dream was to go to Auburn, not necessarily to be a vet. They wanted to be a vet, but it had to come from Auburn. And I knew a lot of people that quit there and took a different track. And maybe if there was some relationships with other schools or maybe some recruitment going on from other places, I've known people that had to leave the country to get into a vet school somewhere and have successful careers. There are plenty of good vets and all that. So I think there's a lot that goes into this issue of veterinarian shortages.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, well, you know, that leads us right into kind of what we're going to talk about today, and this got a lot to do with vet client patient relationship and that kind of stuff. But coming up in June, and Corey, you can elaborate on this, but coming up in June, farmers are going to have, or ranchers, or folks that deal with any kind of animals that have may been used to doing a little bit of doctoring on their animals or whatever, but they're going to have to be able to get antibiotics, they're going to have to go through a veterinarian. And maybe talk a little bit about, you know, when that's going to start and then and why we're having to do that.
So it goes into effect June 11th of this year, and it is part of there's a 5-year, so it's FDA guidelines that's created. Mm-hmm. So it's a 5-year veterinary stewardship plan. And so we saw the first phase of it in 2017 with the VFDs that started, where any oral feed additive antibiotic, you had to get a script. And this is just essentially an extension of that, and it's including all injectable antibiotics. And the main reason the FDA's started this is combating antimicrobial resistance, which means we're starting to see the bugs that we're targeting not responding, you know, from either misuse or just the bugs are getting stronger, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to make the bond between the producer and the veterinarian stronger, so they're making more informed decisions on when to use which antibiotic and mm-hmm. everything like that. And you'll still be able to get it at any feed store, farm supply store. It's just you got to have a script to get it now. So
yeah, mm-hmm. kind of like Aramycin, if folks are familiar with that, if you've been feeding that maybe in mineral or feed or something like that, you've had to have a vet to prescribe that mm-hmm. for you. You can still get it at the feed store, but you obviously had to have that sheet filled out for folks to do that. Talk a little bit, Corey, talk a little bit about maybe some of the products that folks are used to getting at the feed store that they're going to have a prescription for now.
So the main one would be LA-200. You know, everybody, you know, uses that. Penicillin, intermammary treatments, and pretty much any antibiotic that you can inject. I'm a little surprised they did not include dewormers in this, because we're starting to see some resistance in that as well, but for now, it's just going to be antibiotics.
Right. You know, if folks are used to, you know, we talk about Roundup-resistant weeds and mm-hmm. things like this, this is the same concept.
Mm-hmm. I mean, right.
It absolutely is the same concept. And being able to get that, you know, we're treating foot rot and different things like that. Pink eye is a big one that's coming up that folks may be used to getting some LA-300 or 200 and, you know, the other generic brands of that. So from now on, you're going to have a prescription to be able to get that. And, you know, you can still get it from your farm supply store or you can get it from the vet, either one. But you do have to have that prescription to be able to get that.
Don't you think that this will help, though, in the correct diagnosis? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of times, like you were talking about Roundup resistance and on that train of thought, you know, we always say when you're going to be spraying to kill any weeds or insects or whatever, you want to make sure that you have correctly identified the pest that you're trying to treat first, because sometimes the chemical may be working just fine. It's just it's not labeled for what you're trying to kill. And I would, you know, in this situation, I mean, is that going to be a benefit? You know, maybe that's not the benefit that was in the writing on the reason that you did this, but is there some issues with, like, you know, using the wrong product to treat something that's wrong with, you know, the animal that they're trying to treat?
I think it will be a benefit in the long run, but it's going to be a hassle starting out.
Sure.
Because, like, a lot of our clients now, you know, I don't go see every single animal we treat. I
sure.
see a lot of pictures, videos come through my phone of clients that, you know, I do a lot of business with, and I treat over the phone a lot, you know, and that's kind of designed, you know, for this, you know, because it's financially, it's not, it doesn't make sense to go out, say, every single case of pink eye or foot rot or,
well, and you don't have the time to do that.
Right, exactly. You know, so in order to get the script, we do have to have a veterinary client-patient relationship. And every state is going to be different on what it, that defines that. In Kentucky, it's, I have to have a relationship with you, and I have to been on your premises.
Right.
And it says a reasonable amount of time, you know, recently or whatever. Right. So it's not a defined time, but it's pretty much a year. If I've, you know, done work for you the last year, I know you, I know your animals, then, you know, I don't have to go out there to write a script, you know. But people that, you know, if I pulled a calf for you 5 years ago and then you're wanting a script, that, you know,
it's a different ball game.
That, that's going to, you know, we're going to have to do something a little bit different with that, you know. But, you know, and the people that have a good relationship with a vet, it's not going to change just a whole lot. It's just these people that, you know, do a lot of it themselves, and, you know, it's going to affect them because they're going to have to, you know, establish a relationship, and, you know, it's just going to be, you know, it'd be different for them. So,
well, and I think that, you know, those folks that may not have that relationship with their vet, I think that does stem back to, though, the shortage in the large animal vets in these counties that just do not have one. Like, all three of our counties are connecting counties, and all three of us do not have a large animal vet anymore in our county. And so, you know, the vets that we are, that they're working with are two, or, you know, two or three counties away. Hopefully it's just one county away, but it could be two. Or, and that vet, like yourself, you can't physically cover that many people. And so I think that's part of the reason that some of these people may not have that that relationship already built.
And that's, and that's why it's so important.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it's like Corey said, you know, if he's been there, you know, most all of us that are, that are having any work done or having, have livestock, have had him or a vet out at least once a year, you know, for the most part. So that, that will help cover you. But, you know, it's kind of like you said, he can't cover all of those folks at one time. And we do a lot of stuff over the phone, and, you know, you send pictures and those type of things. But you've got to have that relationship established with that veterinarian, and that's why it's so important.
Yep, I agree.
So,
I agree 100%. And it's just like anything else. We just have to adapt to the change, and some people will adapt easier than others because some of us, you know, embrace change a little quicker than others do. Yeah. But, you know, in a few years, it'll be just
be normal in business.
It'll be normal business. It's just that time getting from here to there.
And, you know, that in 2017, the whole feed additive thing came about, you know, and it's taken probably from then till now to folks to kind of get used to that. I mean, it's taken a while, and folks are still not just, you know, real high on it. But, you know, that's, those are the things we have to do to stay in business. And, you know, we obviously want to take care of our livestock. You know, in the beef industry, we've got the BQCA program that we're, you know, and we're supposed to, you know, we treat livestock a certain way, and you handle livestock a certain way, and you give vaccinations and different things of this nature. And that's part of it, the quality care assurance, you know, to assure the folks on the other end of that product that they're getting a quality product. And I think this is just part of what they're trying to do. Don't you think, Corey?
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's a, it'll end up being, I mean, it is a good thing. Mm. Like I said, it's just that change. And,
nobody likes change.
Nobody likes change. No. And nobody's ready for change. I mean, you may hear about it. We know it's coming. We know June 11th's coming. We know that. But most people are not going to be ready for that change on June 11th. And it's going to be some growing pains, or, you know, so to speak.
If you think you're going to struggle with that, you may want to go on and buy you a couple of bottles of LA-300.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and my understanding is that even when we hit that date in June, existing stocks in stores are going to be allowed to use that up. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. So the essentially the the manufacturers will change a label, and once the label reads it has this product has to be used by or under the order of a veterinarian, that's when it has to have a script. So
it may be a little bit after June 11th before, I guess, when folks start getting new stock in, maybe that's right. When.
Yeah, correct. And there's some farm stores that may choose not to even carry those products anymore. Mm-hmm. We saw that with the VFD, there's a few smaller feed mills that's like, I don't want to, deal with this. So that may affect some things too, it's just, we'll have to see. So.
Yeah. And, and that's, but it's also, to me, it's a good thing when we can, when you have to call the vet and say, hey, I've got this problem. What do you recommend? Mm-hmm. And to me, that maybe instead of you just throwing something at it, like LA-300 or something, you can say, well, that's not going to do you any good. Right. You need to use something. You need to use Draxxin or New Floor or something completely different. So from that standpoint, I think that's obviously going to help us a little bit.
In the long run, it's definitely going to help. It's going to be a little bumpy road over the next year or two. So.
It'll be bumpy.
David, you mentioned vaccinations just a second ago, and when you were talking about the quality assurance program and care and quality assurance, and I had the opportunity to judge, I guess I'd call that an opportunity, for our 4-H speaking contest last week. And one of the 4-H'ers, actually, she did a demonstration. It was in the demonstration, but it was on, vaccinating cattle. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty interesting, for one of the 4-H'ers to choose that as their topic. And she did a really good job. And she talked about the benefits of vaccination and things of that nature. And so we do want to keep our animals healthy, and I think part of that is the vaccination and keeping them healthy, and hopefully you won't have to have as many antibiotics and things like that. So, why don't you talk just a little bit about, the vaccinations and the importance of it and the reason behind it.
Yeah, so I think every situation is going to be different, and I think having a closer relationship with your veterinarian, extension agent, to how you want to manage your cattle, what kind of environment they're in, all that plays a role in what you need to vaccinate for, when to vaccinate them, and it just, every situation's different. And, me going over a specific protocol, it's not going to fit.
Sure. It's not a one size fits all.
Correct. So it's, just establishing a relationship with a veterinarian, can save a lot of issues, and it can save money too in the long run, because you have less issues and.
Right.
Worst thing you could have is a death loss.
Right.
And I mean, that's obviously, a dead calf doesn't bring any money at the stockyard.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the main and most important thing is getting that calf to the stockyard or selling a heifer or, whatever we're trying to do. But those are probably the most important things that we're doing. So vaccinating for some of those diseases that
blackleg, your respiratory viral,
IBR,
pink eye, those are kind of the main three that everybody talks about, and then there's a few more that in certain situations you might need, but
Well, since you brought up pink eye, let's talk about that a minute, because there's a lot of discussion on whether that does any good or if you even have the right strain, for that year, when you're vaccinating and all that kind of thing. So tell us a little bit about maybe just your best recommendations on that particular subject.
So it is a moving target. That bacteria does change seemingly every year. 15, 20 years ago, it was just Moraxella salabovis that was dealing with. And the vaccine was better than it is now. Now there's what used to be called the sheep strain, which is Moraxella babiculi, is very prevalent in the area. And up until a year or two, there wasn't any commercial available vaccines. So since I've been a veterinarian, what we've done is cultured eyes in the area and had her own vaccine, you know, made tailored mm-hmm. to the bugs that are, mm-hmm. you know, in this area. The issue with it is, though, that what we had last year may not be what we have this year. So I think it does help. Is it 100%? Absolutely not. You know, yep. So just because you give a shot of pink eye vaccine does not mean you're not going to get
pink eye.
Because, yep. you know, you got to make sure your pastures are clipped, your fly controls, mm-hmm. you know. That's another thing that's hard to, yep. you know, yep. hard to manage. But, right. you know, it's just, it's a multifactorial thing that, you know, that ends up in pink eye. So.
Right. I know, you know, some years we don't have any problem with pink eye. You know, I experience this a lot at my house. And then some years you can't fight it enough. Yep. I mean, you may clip your pastures. You may have, you know, fly tags out. You may have be feeding the fly mineral, you know, doing everything that you think that you possibly can do, and you still have pink eye. And, I mean, it's just relentless. I mean, it's just – you'll have one day, and then the next 2 or 3 days, you'll have another.
Yeah, be another. When it's a problem, it's a real problem.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just like the dominoes keep falling, and we had it in some bred heifers last year, and we actually kept two or three of them that had cloudy eyes. I mean, because they wouldn't have passed, you know, when right. they came through the sale. Yeah. So we kept some of them. I mean, yeah, they can see, but you can still see that cloudy eye, but, yeah. you know, that's just part of it.
Yeah, and I think, two, part of the with the pink eye vaccines, one dose, you know, you get them up to work them once in the spring, you give them one dose of pink eye. Every product will say you need two doses, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that's an issue where a lot of stuff gets, you know, missed. And they're coming out with this relatively new concept of implantable vaccines and vaccines that are in a delayed release oil that you know will help you not have to get them up twice to you know vaccinate them. Those right. are, you know, I haven't used any personally yet, but you know the drug reps and that starting to talk to us about, you know, stuff like that, you know, for future, you know, so once it become a little more confident in them, we might start right. you know implementing them as well. Right. So.
Corey, we talked a little bit about fly control. Folks really struggle, it seems like, on when to put fly tags in. And I mean, obviously, there's no magic date that you can do it. But, you know, what kind of is your recommendation on, you know, when to fly tag or you know, when to implement a lot of those fly control situations that you need to start doing something about it?
So, like right now, we're working a lot of pregnant chicken, a lot of the fall calving cows, working them, working the spring calving cows. And right now, I would get the first pink eye vaccine in them. And then I would come back as late as possible, you know, if you can make it to end of May, 1st of June, you know, put the fly tags in there. Because if you put them in right now, they're going to, by mid-August, probably they're going to be run, you know, shot, you know, and you still got 2 more months to, you know, to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So I, as late as possible, but you also got to worry about if you're getting into June, then the heat stress of working them, you know, at that point too. So.
Yep. You know, and we try to, and you may give some folks advice on feeding this IGR and their mineral. You know, when they need to start feeding it and when they need to quit feeding it. I read something, I guess it was the day before yesterday, about feeding it way on into October or when your frost date, like a month after your frost date or something, just to keep the fly populations down for next year.
Right, yeah. So the fly mineral, it's called an insect growth inhibitor in it, where essentially the fly lays eggs on the manure, and that mineral inhibits those larvae from becoming adults. And so there will be, like, as soon as flies goes away, their eggs are and larvae are still, you know, present. So until you get the first, what they call killing frost, you know, I do recommend feeding. I would start probably feeding that mineral about now, you know, May 1st, somewhere in that ballpark, all the way up until the first hard frost.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes we forget about that. And I think folks, you know, if you start feeding that, you need to keep feeding it because you're going to have another run of flies. If you quit feeding it in the middle of the summer, you're going to have another population of flies that you have to deal with. And I mean, that tends to me seems like that we have more pink eye problems at that time of year, you know, that July, August, that really hot September, even, you know.
Yeah. Your fly control's going down, and also your vaccination, you know, effectiveness is going down at that point.
Mineral uptake in general is probably going down in that time too. So,
Yeah, there's a lot of things at play there, especially the folks of us that are got lots of endophyte in our fescue, you know, and cattle are their temperature is hotter than normal, and they stay in the pond more, stay in the shade
more.
Yeah, that's right. Not out in it as much as before. So
when you you see things probably every year, and I know it's always different. There's no two farms alike. There's no 2 years alike. And so I'll frame that a little bit, frame that first. But, and you already talked about pink eye and discussing that, and know that is just something we know every year that you need to be looking for. You need to be treating or trying to prevent early on and the steps and things to do for that. Are there some other things too that we need to be thinking about as we go into summer that you see more years than you don't in the summertime of some things that maybe to be looking for, or is there some things that you need to be doing to prevent some things that could happen throughout the summer?
So anaplasmosis is one that, you know, we're seeing more and more each year, and there's not a good vaccine for that. And so what it is it's a bacteria that's transmitted by ticks, biting flies, dirty needles, and it causes cows become anemic, run a high fever, and, you know, a majority of them do die. They don't, by the time you catch it, realize what's going on, you know, they're, you know, for the most part, too far gone, you know.
Right.
So there's several farms where we've diagnosed it on that farm that start feeding CTC, you know, in their mineral from April into November to, you know, combat that.
Is that a disease that's mostly found in the summertime? That's really not a wintertime thing.
Yeah, you will see a few, you know, cases when it's cold, but you know, they contracted it when it was hot.
Right.
You know, so
do you see more of that, and do you attribute seeing more of that since we've not been able to have CTC in our mineral, you know, on a regular basis?
It's about the same, I would say. You know, I've seen it in farms that still do feed it, and I've seen it in, you know, farms that don't. You know, and typically that's more of like a, you won't ever see it in calves or replacement heifers, you know. It's more of a, you know, 4 to 10 year old cow that you're going to see that in. And they'll be kind of off to themselves, you know, look pretty sick. So,
Have you had any experience, or have you seen any, or treated, or I guess treated any issues with the Asian longhorn tick? You know, our entomologist, Dr. Jonathan Larson, you know, he's done some trainings for ag agents and actually talked to some cattle groups across Kentucky this winter, just kind of letting these cattle producers know that this is a relatively new tick, but that, you know, there can be there's been cattle that's we lost because of this tick. So have you had any experience with that, or do you have anything you want to say about that?
I haven't seen it may have seen me, but I didn't see it
yet, right. Sure.
But it's an emerging thing, but I have not personally diagnosed, you know, any. And we did send a few to the lab suspecting potentially that, but mm-hmm. it was anaplast, you know, every yeah. time so far.
Right.
It behaves very similar.
Well, to that's what he said. Yeah. That's what Dr. Larson always said is that, you know, they do have, a lot of times they have the same symptoms. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, I think one of the things that he said, because he was at Webster County, and one of the things he said that, you know, cattle producers just really aren't used to checking ears and things like that for ticks when the cattle just are acting funny and there's, you know, they're just, you know, you can't really, they're not right. They're just acting yeah. funny, and to add that to that list of things that you're checking, you know, to check their ears in other places just to see, because it could be, you know, and well, I know.
Corey, if they do find, say they suspect it is, you know, obviously they want to get a sample and get that to y'all or get it to the extension office to get it sent in. But what can they do to, if they suspect that that's what that is, what can they do to help that situation?
So the, like with anaplast, you can do like the CTC and the mm-hmm. mineral, you yep. know, everything like that. But a lot of the topical pour-on insecticides for cattle will prevent, you know, ticks.
Mm-hmm.
When you are working the cattle, use a new needle on each cow. Mm-hmm. You know, anything that can transmit blood from one animal to another can,
right.
you know, just mm-hmm. mitigating that, you know.
So, right.
And, yep. and it's my understanding there's going to be some new products in the next year or two more so designed for tick control in cattle. That's supposed pretty promising from what I've been hearing. Yep. You know, they're just not readily available, you know, yep. right now.
For the most part, is this an issue that has been more south of where we're located right now?
It has. I think in recent years it's become more of a widespread, mm-hmm. you know, because when I was in Alabama, I worked for a vet in and out of high school and undergrad mm-hmm. and vet school for 10, 11 years, and I can count the number of times on one hand that we saw that, you know, yeah. in that amount of time. And then up here now, it's, you know, mm-hmm. from July to September, it's one or two a week, you know,
yeah.
that, you know,
yeah.
we're seeing it. So yeah. I think it's just everywhere it's becoming a more and more of an issue.
And I've gotten some pretty big, we've worked cattle several times this spring, and I've gotten some pretty big ticks.
Mm-hmm.
They're just regular ticks, but I mean, yeah. I've gotten some off of cattle, so they're out there and they're
yeah,
present.
It's been
sure.
about 3 weeks I've been, you know, seeing them on them, so yeah. they come out quick this year, which is mm-hmm. this area is relatively mild winter, so mm-hmm. The bugs are going to be bad this year, I think.
Yeah.
So.
You know, we're to the point in our show where we usually do a timely tip, and I don't know, during all this, you may have been thinking one that you want to add, but just throwing this out there for everybody listening, if you don't have that current vet-client-patient relationship, now's the time to get it started. We know June's going to be the changeover date for the availability for these antibiotics, having to come through a vet and having to have that prescription written. So my recommendation this week for this week's timely tip would be to start that vet-client relationship. Find a veterinarian that's close enough you can work with. I feel like because of the shortage of large animal vets anyway, that there's going to be a scramble sometime probably midsummer of people trying to get that veterinarian and get them to their farm. So my recommendation for this week's timely tip would be to get that started if you don't already have it.
No, I agree. And to kind of piggyback off what we've been talking about the whole time, if you know of any high school kids, you know, college kids wanting to potentially do large animal medicine, get them in a clinic somewhere where they can get some experience and see if that's really want to do them mm-hmm. and just kind of, yep. you know, push them to that area and then talk with your local agents to, you know, say, I need, you know, because the more voices they hear, the more everybody's going to help to, you know, yep. feel the need.
Getting them in that clinic and in that work environment for a co-op student or an internship or whatever will do one of two things. It'll either drive them to it or away from it,
right.
one of the
yeah.
two, which
yeah.
is good. That's good yeah. early.
Yeah. Either way it goes yeah. is good because they need to know.
And that's a good reminder for folks that have contact with their state legislators or anybody that, you know, that there's funding that's needed for this. I mean, this is a serious issue, yeah. and we need to be on top of it from an agriculture standpoint for sure.
And I will say, too, I appreciate the vet clinics. They really do open their doors. The ones that I've ever talked to, the vets that I've talked to or, you know, that we work with, they are always open to students that are thinking about going into that career. They're very good about opening those doors and letting you come in and shadow them and or you all and work with you and tag along with you. And you know, I appreciate that because I think that, like you said, that's they need to know what they're getting into. And the only way you're going to know that is get in there and do it. And yeah.
Another great reason to be living in rural America.
Absolutely.
That's right.
For sure. That it is, you know, and so.
Along with all the other great reasons.
That's right.
Yeah. I agree.
Well, Corey, we appreciate you being here with us. I think this is a good show. I think folks will get a lot out of it. We want to thank you and our host for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. I hope you've enjoyed our show and will make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.